given Lubinda jumped off a bridge this week and popped up smiling. Mr. Lubinda is the Minister of Information Broadcasting and Tourism of Zambia, nearly 50 years old and just a tad podgy, judging from photographs. On New Year's Eve, an Australian traveler named Aaron Langworthy made a bungee cord jump off a bridge at Victoria Falls along the Zambezi River, and the cord snapped. The first and only time in 17 years and over 150,000 jumps, officials say. Mr. Langworthy fell almost 400 feet into the river rapids, which, by the way, abound with crocodiles, and managed to swim safely to a rocky shore despite breaking her collarbone and being bound at the ankles by the busted bungee. She's now recovering and giving interviews at a hospital in South Africa. The video of her jump, splash, and dauntless swim has been seen all over the world. The company that runs the jump say they've removed all bungee cords produced from the same batch of rubber as the cord that snapped, run tests, and it's perfectly safe to resume jumping off that high bridge over a crocodile-infested river. A lot of people might say, "Oh, really? Thanks. But I think I'll just watch the butterflies. Maybe we'll go to the Bowling Hall of Fame in St. Louis. A 10-pounder might fall on your toe there, but you won't wind up as snack cakes for a crocodile." Tourism attracts about 800,000 people to the Zambian side of Victoria Falls each year. They spend money on food, lodging, snow globes, whitewater rafting, hippo watching, and bungee jumping. The government doesn't want that number falling off. Perhaps that's a poor choice of words. So, Minister Lubinda came to the bridge this week and took a bungee nosedive over the Zambezi. "Let everyone come and do it," he said. "I am hoping that all those who watched a middle-aged person jumping down the bridge and coming back up smiling will be encouraged not just to jump, but also to come and visit Zambia." Now, there's something truly winning about a politician who's willing to jump off a bridge to demonstrate his sincerity. Imagine how it might winnow the field to include a bridge jump in U.S. presidential candidate debates. Certainly would leave more time for follow-up questions. Imagine, for that matter, how our own most devout convictions about work, family, love, caring for others, or fixing the economy might plunge off a cliff if first we had to live by the advice we so freely give others. It's refreshing to see anyone not just talk the talk or walk the walk, but jump. You're listening to NPR News. The new film Pina almost didn't get made, yet it's now Germany's official Oscar entry and a collaboration between two giants of that country's post-war generation of artists, the late choreographer Pina Bausch and the filmmaker Wim Wenders. The documentary captures Bausch's groundbreaking modern dance works in 3D. The film was just opened in New York and Los Angeles. Pat Dahl reports.
Wim Wenders is best known in the U.S. for such 1980s dramas as Paris, Texas, and Wings of Desire. Several books of his art photographs have been published, and Wenders' interest in music led him to make the much-loved 1999 documentary, The Buena Vista Social Club. But modern dance was not one of his interests.
Dance included me out. The first time I ever saw the Pina Bausch Company perform, my girlfriend really, literally dragged me.
It was a 1985 performance by Bausch's company, the Tanztheater Wuppertal.
I found myself on the edge of my seat, crying like a baby after 5 minutes and crying through the entire thing, helplessly crying. It was like lightning struck me. It changed my life that night. This unknown woman, Pina Bausch, showed me in 40 minutes more about men and women than the entire history of cinema.
Wenders met Bausch the next day, and immediately they began to plan a film together. She set two ground rules: no biography of her, no interview with her, just the dances that had won her nearly every major global prize. The performance Wenders saw was Bausch's signature piece, Café Müller. Wenders ultimately filmed it for his documentary. The stage is set as a café, with tables and chairs. A woman blindly plods across the room. A startled man pushes chairs out of her way to clear a path across a space normally thought of as a gathering spot. People do not connect easily in Café Müller, however, and their jerky, hesitant attempts become a social metaphor. A woman repeatedly throws herself against a wall and sticks to it in awkward poses.
What kind of feeling must this woman have to do something like this? I mean, it's not so difficult to think this, no?
Pina Bausch defended her work to NPR in 1988, when some critics and audiences were saying that it was too ugly to be called dance.
If people are very sad or something, it doesn't look so pretty. In ballet, usually you speak about certain kind of people. You have a different story. You have it's almost like a fairy tale. It's a fable. It's like princess. In this, we speak about us. We are the heroes on the street.
She had changed the whole notion of what dance was.
Mark Sweat is the classical music critic of the Los Angeles Times. He says that Bausch opened the door for modern choreographers in terms of subject matter and staging, with her feminist portrayal of sexual aggression and her use of nudity.
She dealt with themes of destruction, and it could feel very nihilistic, except that she always put the pieces back together. You didn't come out depressed, ever, from the work. You could come out a little confused, a little bewildered, but also inspired.
Bewildered, perhaps, Swed says, because you never knew what Bausch might do to a stage. Dancers could be pounding through several tons of peat covering the floor, or sand, or 4,000 pink carnations, or they might swim on a river created on an opera house stage, or in rain, real water, and lots of it. Wim Wenders wanted to capture it all in his documentary, but first he had to find the right way to film dance.
Between dance and film, there was a difficulty, and there was always like an invisible wall, and I couldn't break that wall.
It took him nearly 20 years to find the answer at a U2 concert film, 3D.
For the first time, we had a tool as filmmakers that allowed us to actually be in space, be in the same element as the dancers.
The bulky camera and heavy rigs required lots of planning. Wenders says he needed a dinosaur of a crane to film stage performances. By June 2009, he was ready to shoot rehearsals and show Bausch the results. And then, just a few days before the cameras were to roll, the choreographer died. She had been diagnosed with lung cancer less than a week earlier.
And I immediately canceled the film because we had wanted to make this together for 20 years. And the fact that there is a film after all is, I strictly owe it to the dancers. And we could no longer make a film with Pina, but we realized there was a film to be made for Pina.
He followed her wishes and concentrated on the dances. But he did weave into these the dancers' thoughts about Pina Bausch. We see what he calls silent portraits of the troupe. We hear the performers' interior monologues.
Meeting Pina was like finding a language, finally. Before, I didn't know how to talk. And then she suddenly gave me a way to express myself, a vocabulary. When I began, I was pretty shy. I still am. And after many months of rehearsing, she called me and said, "You just have to get crazier." And that was the only comment in almost 20 years.
Following most of these monologues are short solo or duet performances set all around Wuppertal, at its famous monorail, in traffic, on slag heaps outside the industrial city. These sequences were filmed with the lightweight 3D cameras that became available after 2009. But exactly how to make the technology work for the story he wanted to tell was always Wenders's biggest challenge. After all, this was not a sci-fi epic or an action blockbuster.
I figured from the beginning we had to invent a different kind of idea, and the film could not be effect-driven because the attraction of our film was the dance itself and Pina's work and not the technology with which we shot it. So I wanted to invent a 3D that was all natural and was gentle to the eyes, and that you would almost forget after a few minutes, and you'd really forget that you ever saw dance differently.
And just as seeing Pina Bausch perform for the first time changed his life, Wim Wenders says so has 3D. Filming in 2D now would seem like returning to something ancient. So his next film will be a fictional 3D journey into a family. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. The NFL playoffs are well underway. Eight teams still standing. Two of them will be sent home today. Well, I bet most of them have pretty nice homes anyway. From the studios of New England Public Radio, we're joined now by Howard Bryant of ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine, and ESPN the scented candle. Howard, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Listen, Howard, a lot of people were flabbergasted to see the Denver Broncos last week. Upset.
Oh, boy.
Upset the Pittsburgh Steelers. I gather you know of at least one sage analyst who called it that way, right?
Oh, I think it might be you. Might it be you?
Yes, come to think of it. I'm glad you remembered that. pure dumb luck on my part. But what did we see at work that might give Denver some chance today?
I think you saw a couple of things at work. The first thing you saw, which I don't think is going to help Denver tonight, is a great deal of overconfidence on the part of the Pittsburgh Steelers. I don't think their defensive backs had any respect for Tim Tebow. I don't think they thought he could beat them. I don't think you're going to see such under-preparation from the Patriots. But on the part of the Broncos, you've got a very tough team, and they win through a lot of counter-programming. Nobody runs the football anymore in the NFL, and the Denver Broncos do. So what they do is they line you up expecting the run, and they're hoping that Tim Tebow can break for big plays, which he did constantly against Pittsburgh.
I'm going to pick the Broncos by 6 again, okay?
I think your luck's going to run out this time.
All right. Well, my luck, not theirs. Another big game, though, tonight, San Francisco 49ers against the New Orleans Saints. Now, the 49ers this year have been one of the greatest recovery stories since Ozzy Osbourne. defense is supposed to win championships.
Yeah, and they're terrific. And what you've got here is this wonderful, wonderful offensive team in Drew Brees going up against San Francisco, which is the best defensive team in the league this year. And it's that great classic matchup of defense versus offense. And I'm not going to fall for the trap and think that the Saints are going to win this game by 30 points, because I think that good defenses can make a great offense look normal. But I do think that the Saints are going to win simply because I just don't see anybody stopping the Saints enough, or San Francisco scoring enough points to win that game.
Professional tennis season opens up, kicks off in earnest this week with the Australian Open. Let's talk about the women's side.
Yeah, first slam of the year, and it's going to be a terrific, terrific tournament, because I think on the women's side you've got two major issues. One is we're waiting for the crowning of a new queen. You had four different women winning the majors last year, so you don't have that dominant woman, and everyone's waiting to see who it's going to be. I think it's going to come down to Petra Kvitova, who's number 2 in the world, or Victoria Azarenka, who's number 3 in the world. Or maybe it's going to be one of the old ones coming back. Obviously, when Serena is at her best, she's the best player in the world still. But you just wonder if her health can keep up enough to get her over the top.
And on the men's side, are we living in the tennis age of Novak Djokovic?
Well, the big question is whether or not anybody can take down Novak Djokovic after the year that he had. He won 3 out of the 4 majors. He destroyed Rafael Nadal, who was then the number 1 player in the world. And can he duplicate that is the big question. And also the big question for me is whether or not Roger Federer has one more major in him. I think he's going to win a major, and I think it might be the Australian Open because of how well he finished the year after the U.S. Open. But once again, the star of the year of 2011, and obviously going in, the star of the year this year is Novak Djokovic.
Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Obesity is, forgive the expression, a huge problem in America. Not just obesity that leads to clogged arteries, straining hearts, split pants, and fat-inflicted diseases, but an obesity of information that clogs our eyes and our inboxes, a lot of unhealthy information that's deep-fried in our own preconceptions. Clay Johnson, an open-source internet activist and founder of Blue State Digital, which provided the online strategy for the 2008 Obama campaign, has a new nonpartisan book which recommends some ways to slim and stretch our minds, The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. Clay Johnson joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
And begin with the analogy, please, that you make between how Americans produce and eat food and how we consume information.
Well, you know, our bodies are wired to love salt, fat, and sugar. We love it because it tastes good. But, you know, our minds are really wired to be affirmed and to be told that we're right. And that's the central premise of the information diet. It's really who wants to hear the truth when they can hear that they're right? Who wants to be informed when they can be affirmed?
You say some of this thinking began to develop when you worked for Howard Dean's presidential campaign.
Sure. I noticed there that because of our media diets, We were consuming everything that was great about Howard Dean. Even after that Scream incident in Iowa, we still thought we could win and that we would make it. And, you know, we went on to New Hampshire and South Carolina thinking that, you know, victory was just around the corner. And that's what made me start thinking, there's something going on here with our media diets where even the most highly informed of us mm-hmm. can be ignorant.
You say, which is a wonderful phrase, clicks have consequences.
That's right. Just because your boss doesn't see you looking at that Kim Kardashian post doesn't mean that it's not without consequence. When you click on it, you're making it so that it's more visible to other people. Mm-hmm. That means an information diet is something that's of ethical consequence to you and others.
And explain to us, with your expertise in this world, how people, in a sense, tip their hand as to what they're searching and how it just winds up amplifying.
Well, when you go to the Huffington Post or many major media outlets right now, what they do is they'll come up with maybe 20 or 30 or maybe just two different headlines for a particular story. And when you click on that, that's a vote for one of those headlines, the headline that you clicked on. Over time, the headline with the most clicks wins and goes on the front page. The other interesting thing is a lot of AOL properties and other content farms are what they called, who are trying to sort of commoditize the production of content, wake up in the morning and look on Google search trends. Google makes it publicly available. What are the top things that people are searching for every moment? And so editorial decisions get made based on this information. It's really this idea of voting for, in very small, almost non-transparent, subconscious ways for content that isn't very good for people.
Well, that's to return to the food analogy. You say that you don't want to necessarily blame the online communities or right. services any more than you want to blame Kentucky Fried Chicken for
right.
every instance of obesity because nobody is forced to go in there and buy a bucket of chicken.
Right. Obesity is a complicated problem, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, obesity has to do with access and obesity has to do with economic conditions. But it sometimes also has to do with overeating. And the same thing happens with information. I think a lot of people don't have great access to information and good information, that's for sure. But also in the world of the internet, we have almost universal access to everything that we need. And that means that we have to make empowered decisions and informed decisions about what it is that we're consuming.
You actually recommend an information diet that is kind of the equivalent to Michael Pollan's famous food diet, which is eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
That's right. It's, seek not too much, mostly facts, right? Eat low on the sort of information food chain and stick close to sources. Mm-hmm. If it's an article about a bill in Congress or even at, you know, a state house somewhere, going deep and actually trying to read the bill itself is really, I think, advantageous. And it takes a little bit of time to pick up. Bills are not, you know, House resolutions are not the most entertaining things to read for most
yeah.
people. But getting to know what our legislative language is helps us, I think, become better citizens.
But what if people like the junk info diet?
Well, what if people like Cheetos, right? The question is, can we make enough people go, hey, you know what? I'm done. I'm done with the sort of sensationalism of media. I'm done being taken advantage of by media companies so that I can have ads sold to me. And do sort of what Walmart's doing with Whole Foods, right? So Walmart started realizing that it was losing high-end customers and going, gosh, you know, we've got to start carrying fresh fruits and vegetables in Walmart stores too. And now Walmart is cutting its salt, fat, and sugar content. And I think that that same thing can happen with information. If we want to make media better, then we've got to start consuming better media.
Clay Johnson, his new book, The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. Thanks so much.
It was great to be here.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Later today, the temperature inside a giant spinning furnace in Tucson, Arizona, will reach 2,140 degrees Fahrenheit. 21 tons of glass will become molten and flow into a honeycomb frame. The goal is to make a giant mirror 27 feet across. It'll be one of the seven mirrors that make up the giant Magellan Telescope. That's the telescope being built in the Andes Mountains in Chile. NPR's Joe Palca is at the Mirror Lab at the University of Arizona, and he joins me on the line from there. Joe, describe where you're standing right now.
Okay, so now I'm standing right over this spinning giant furnace. It's like a giant merry-go-round, and it's got this glass that's slowly being heated up, and it will begin to flow into this honeycomb mold. But I'm going to step away from here because it's really noisy.
So, Joe, explain what will happen once this mirror is mounted. What will we be able to see in outer space that we cannot see right now?
Well, the whole name of the game in astronomy is getting photons into your telescope. The larger the mirror, the more photons you get. And this is also going to get very high resolution. So they expect that they may actually be able to image planets going around stars with this telescope. And they also think they may be able to use it to look way back to the earliest things that formed in the universe, and that will inform theories about how the universe was created in the first place.
When will this all be ready?
They're aiming for 2020.
Oh, man.
But telescopes tend to slip, and when money is short, things slow down, so 2020 is the optimistic start.
So, Joe, we have to wait 8 years before we can see some of these images.
Yeah, it's and this is only the second. They've got five more mirrors to make, so they're actually beginning to start what they hope will be a mirror a year until they're finished, and then they'll begin shipping them down to Chile.
All right, you promised to update us in 2020?
Absolutely.
That's NPR's Joe Palca at the Mirror Lab at the University of Arizona. Joe, thanks.
You bet.
Coming up, playwright and author Alan Bennett based some of the characters in his new book, Smut, on people in his life, at least in part.
Whether they have the rich and alarming secret lives I've wished on them, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say.
Alan Bennett ditches his Victorian sensibilities. That's in the next part of All Things Considered from NPR News.